A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it starts with chocolate cake and Coca-Cola for breakfast. Which, look, moving between apartments with an empty fridge, I'm not here to judge the breakfast choices. The problem is what happened after. He's got post-gallbladder surgery bloating, and this particular meal has him feeling like a balloon. But here's the real thing he's asking about. The bloating isn't just uncomfortable, it's hijacking his brain. He's making spelling errors in simple texts, losing his train of thought walking around the house, and anything physical. Bending over to pick up Ezra, doing DIY-fi, becomes miserable. He's got ADHD, which he thinks amplifies the whole thing, and he wants to know, what is actually happening neurologically when your stomach distends and your cognition just... And more importantly, are there mental techniques to break that loop?
This is a fantastic question, because he's identified something that most bloating research doesn't even touch. He's not asking about the gas. He's asking about why the gas makes him unable to spell.
And he drew this really sharp distinction. He said he'd rather run on an empty stomach feeling hungry than run while bloated. Hunger is also a visceral signal. So why does one derail him and the other doesn't?
That line is the key to the whole episode. Hunger and bloating are both interoceptive signals. They're messages from inside your body. But the brain treats them completely differently. Hunger is a low salience, predictable signal. Your brain has been getting hungry since you were a baby. It's background noise. Bloating, especially after gallbladder surgery, is a high salience signal that your brain reads as, something's wrong in here. And for someone with ADHD, that alarm goes off even louder.
The spelling errors aren't just, I'm distracted because I feel gross. There's an actual neurological competition for resources happening.
And that's what we're going to trace today. What's actually happening in the brain when the gut sends up a distress signal, why ADHD brains might be wired to amplify that signal, and whether you can train yourself to turn down the volume. Let's define what we're actually talking about here, because brain fog gets thrown around loosely. When Daniel says he's making spelling errors he wouldn't normally make, that's not a vague feeling. That's a measurable cognitive deficit. Researchers have quantified this. A study on visceral distension found reaction time on cognitive tasks increases by 15 to 20% in people who are sensitive to those gut signals. Working memory takes a hit. You're literally slower and less accurate.
15 to 20% is not subtle. That's the difference between typing a coherent sentence and looking like you've forgotten how words work.
And this isn't pain. Pain is a different category. It has its own well-studied effects on cognition. What Daniel's describing is something more specific, postprandial bloating that triggers a state of cognitive distraction without necessarily being painful. The distension itself is the trigger.
We're not talking about, my stomach hurts and I can't think. We're talking about, my stomach is stretched and my brain has decided that's the most important thing happening right now.
That's exactly the framing. And the mechanism behind it is something called interoceptive interference. Interoception is your brain's perception of your body's internal state. Heartbeat, hunger, breath, and yes, gut distension. These signals compete for the same attentional bandwidth that you need for executive functions. Orthographic processing, that's the brain system that handles spelling, lives in the left fusiform gyrus. Task switching, which is what you're doing when you walk from one room to another and need to remember why you went there, lives in the prefrontal cortex. When a high salience visceral signal floods the system, those regions lose resources.
The spelling errors are literally the brain reallocating processing power to something is stretching in my abdomen.
That's the interoceptive interference model. And the gut-brain axis is the highway this all travels on. It's bidirectional. The gut sends signals up, the brain sends signals down. But what makes this a loop rather than a one-way announcement is that the brain's interpretation of the gut signal determines how disruptive it becomes. Two people with the same amount of gas can have completely different cognitive experiences depending on how their brain reads the signal.
Which is why Daniel's question about mental techniques is actually the right question. If the brain is amplifying the signal, maybe the brain can learn to turn down the gain.
That's where we're headed. But first, we need to understand exactly how that amplification works, and why an ADHD brain might be wired for a louder alarm. There was a major review in Nature Reviews Gastroenterology and Hepatology last year that really nailed this down. They established that bloating-related distress isn't primarily about gas volume. It's about visceral hypersensitivity, how sensitively your brain reads the stretch signals coming from your gut. The gas might be modest, but the brain's interpretation of it is turned up to 11.
Two people eat the same cake, produce the same amount of gas, and one is fine while the other can't spell cake anymore.
And the pathway this travels is the vagus nerve. The gut distends, stretch receptors fire, and those signals run straight up the vagus to two brain regions that are going to sound familiar, the insula and the anterior cingulate cortex.
Those regions do what, exactly, when they're not busy processing bloating?
The insula is your interoceptive hub. It builds your moment-to-moment sense of your body's state. The anterior cingulate handles error monitoring and attentional control. It's the part of your brain that flags when something needs your attention right now, so bloating hits both of them simultaneously. The insula says your gut is stretched, and the ACC says this is urgent, redirect resources.
Which means the same hardware Daniel needs to catch a spelling error is being commandeered to process your stomach is now a balloon.
This is where Lisa Feldman-Barrett's body budget model becomes really useful. Your brain is constantly running a metabolic budget, predicting what your body needs and allocating resources accordingly. A high salience interoceptive signal like bloating is treated as an immediate expense. The brain drains resources from executive functions to pay for processing the gut alarm. Working memory shrinks. Attentional control weakens. That 15 to 20% reaction time slowdown we mentioned earlier. That's the body budget being overdrawn.
Which also explains why Daniel can lose his train of thought just walking across a room. Task switching is expensive, even on a good day. Add a bloating tax, and the brain drops the ball between rooms.
Now let's layer in the ADHD piece, because this is where it gets really interesting for Daniel specifically. There was a study in Biological Psychiatry Cognitive Neuroscience in 2023 that looked at exactly this. They found that adults with ADHD show heightened insula reactivity to gastric distension compared to neurotypical controls.
His brain's alarm system is literally louder.
It's not just that he's more distractible in general, though that's true. It's that the interoceptive signal itself is amplified at the point of processing. The insula fires harder. The ACC flags the signal as more urgent. And ADHD already involves altered interoceptive accuracy. Some people with ADHD are hypoaware of body signals. They don't notice hunger until they're ravenous. But others, and Daniel sounds like he's in this camp, are hyperaware. They feel every internal shift with unusual intensity.
He did say he feels very in touch with his body, which sounds like a good thing, until it means your gut is hijacking your prefrontal cortex every time you eat the wrong breakfast.
It's a double-edged sword. Heightened interoceptive awareness can be genuinely useful, catching illness early, being attuned to stress signals. But with bloating, it becomes a cognitive liability.
Then the loop closes. He's bloated. He's distracted. The distraction itself is stressful, especially when he's trying to function, text someone back, take care of Ezra, and stress activates the sympathetic nervous system, which alters gut motility, which produces more bloating.
That's the self-reinforcing spiral. The cognitive load of trying to push through the distraction actually amplifies the visceral signal. Your brain is already working harder to maintain focus against the interoceptive noise, and that effort itself is a stressor. Cortisol rises, gut transit slows or spasms depending on the person, and the physical bloating worsens. Now the signal coming up the vagus nerve is even stronger, and the insula fires even harder.
The mental technique question isn't just about coping. It's about breaking a neurophysiological loop before it feeds itself.
And there's a fascinating evolutionary angle here that connects back to Daniel's point about preferring to run hungry. Hunger is a low salience signal because, evolutionarily, it's normal. Your ancestors were hungry between meals all the time. If hunger derailed cognition every time it showed up, we wouldn't have made it as a species. But distension? A stretched, uncomfortable gut that signals something potentially dangerous. Obstruction, inflammation, something you ate that might be toxic. The brain treats it as a threat signal, not a maintenance reminder.
Which is why, just ignore it, is terrible advice. You're telling someone to override a threat detection system with willpower.
For someone with ADHD, whose anterior cingulate is already flagging the signal as high priority, that's essentially impossible. The question isn't how to ignore the signal, it's how to retrain the brain's interpretation of it. There's another layer to this that I think Daniel's hinting at when he talks about bending over to pick up Ezra. That's not just a cognitive distraction, that's proprioception, your brain's internal map of where your body is in space. When your abdomen is distended, that map is suddenly wrong.
The brain expects a flat stomach, and instead it's getting sensory feedback that says, "There's a beach ball here now."
That mismatch is called a proprioceptive prediction error. Your brain predicted one body configuration, got another, and now has to reconcile the difference. That reconciliation burns cognitive resources on top of everything else the insula is already processing. And when you bend over, you're physically compressing the distended area, which sends an even stronger signal up the vagus nerve.
The physical act of leaning down to grab a toddler isn't just uncomfortable. It's feeding fresh data into a system that's already overloaded.
This is where most bloating treatments fall short. Simethicone, digestive enzymes, dietary changes, they're targeting the gas. They're trying to reduce the physical stimulus, which makes sense, and for many people it helps. But the 2025 review in Gastroenterology and Hepatology found something striking. Up to 40% of bloating patients have abdominophrenic dyssynergia, a coordination problem where the brain doesn't properly synchronize the diaphragm and abdominal wall.
Wait, so for nearly half of people with chronic bloating, the problem isn't how much gas they have, it's that their brain is telling their muscles to do the wrong thing.
When you eat, your diaphragm should relax and your abdominal wall should accommodate. In abdominophrenic dyssynergia, the diaphragm contracts and the abdominal wall tenses. The gas has nowhere to go, so the belly distends outward. The brain is literally creating the bloat through muscle miscoordination.
Which is why biofeedback started getting traction for this. You train people to see what their muscles are doing in real time and relearn the coordination.
And that's the physical biofeedback angle. But what's newer, and what Daniel's really asking about, is whether we can apply similar retraining principles to the cognitive side. Can you do biofeedback for the brain's interpretation of the signal, not just the muscle coordination?
That's where these mental techniques start to look less like coping strategies and more like actual neurological retraining.
There was a really interesting pilot study in neurogastroenterology and motility last year that tested exactly this. They took patients with chronic bloating and put them through 8 weeks of interoceptive exposure therapy. The idea is borrowed from anxiety treatment. You systematically expose yourself to the sensation you're afraid of. In this case, the feeling of being bloated, while practicing cognitive diffusion. You learn to observe the sensation without letting it hijack your attention.
What does that actually sound like in practice?
It's deceptively simple. You notice the bloating, and instead of thinking, "I can't function, I'm so bloated, this is ruining my morning," you say something like, "I notice my stomach feels tight, and I can still type this email." You're acknowledging the signal without fusing with it. After 8 weeks, the study found a 40% reduction in bloating-related distress.
40% is substantial. That's not just, "I feel a little better about being bloated." That's a meaningful change in how disruptive the sensation is.
The mechanism is likely that you're training the anterior cingulate cortex to stop flagging the signal as catastrophic. The signal still arrives, the gas is still there, but the ACC stops sounding the alarm at full volume.
Which seems especially relevant for Daniel's ADHD brain, where that alarm is already calibrated high.
There's a second technique that's even more directly targeting the attentional mechanism. It's called visceral attention shifting, and it uses a dual-task paradigm. The idea is that attentional capacity is finite. If you deliberately fill that capacity with a competing cognitive task while you're bloated, you practice disengaging from the gut signal.
You're not ignoring the bloating. You're giving your brain something else to chew on.
And the task should be low stakes but cognitively engaging. Naming categories, types of fruit, countries in South America. Counting backwards by sevens from 100. Something that requires just enough bandwidth that your brain can't simultaneously obsess over the gut signal. You start with 30 seconds, build to 2 minutes. Over time, your brain learns that the bloating signal doesn't require full attentional capture.
This sounds like it would be particularly useful for someone with ADHD, because the ADHD brain is already prone to hyperfocus on whatever signal is loudest. Giving it a structured competing signal is almost like redirecting a toddler with a toy.
That's not a bad analogy. And the third technique is the one I think is most immediately useful in the moment, breath work as a circuit breaker. Slow diaphragmatic breathing activates what's called the vagal break. Your vagus nerve has an inhibitory pathway that, when stimulated by slow exhalation, reduces sympathetic nervous system arousal. 4 seconds in, 6 seconds out, for 2 minutes.
That directly targets the insula's reactivity.
The extended exhale stimulates vagal afferents that project to the insula, essentially telling it to stand down. It's not just relaxation, it's a direct neurological intervention. For Daniel's scenario with Ezra, a 30-second version before bending over to pick him up could reduce that proprioceptive prediction error we talked about. The brain is calmer, the body map is more flexible, and the movement doesn't trigger the same cascade.
We've got three distinct approaches. Interoceptive exposure for long-term retraining, attention shifting for building cognitive flexibility during episodes, and breath work as the real-time emergency break.
None of these replace dietary management or medical treatment. If certain foods trigger the bloating, you still avoid them when you can. But as Daniel said, sometimes you make mistakes, sometimes life happens, sometimes you're between apartments eating birthday cake for breakfast. These techniques are for those moments.
Which raises the bigger question. If we can train the brain to turn down the volume on bloating, what else can we train it to do?
Let's distill this into something you can actually use the next time you're bloated and need to function. Three techniques, different time scales, all targeting the neurological loop rather than the gas itself.
The first one is almost embarrassingly simple. Name the sensation out loud or in your head. My stomach is distended, and my brain is interpreting this as urgent.
This isn't just self-talk fluff. Effect labeling research shows that putting a feeling into words activates the prefrontal cortex and dampens amygdala reactivity. The effect size is substantial, a 20 to 30% reduction in distress just from naming what's happening. You're essentially telling your anterior cingulate cortex, I see the alarm, I've logged it, stand down.
Which for Daniel, whose ACC is firing at full volume, is like manually turning down a dial the brain forgot to adjust.
Second technique, and this is the one I'd recommend as a first-line intervention in the moment, the 2-minute vagal reset. 4 seconds inhale, 6 seconds exhale for 2 minutes. The extended exhale stimulates vagal afferents that project directly to the insula. It's not a relaxation trick, it's a neurological circuit breaker.
2 minutes is short enough that you can actually do it, even between text messages.
The third one is specifically for ADHD listeners, and Daniel should hear this. When bloating hits, pair it with a single simple cognitive task, counting backwards from 100 by sevens, naming every country you can think of that starts with B. Start with 30 seconds, build to 2 minutes over time. You're not distracting yourself, you're training attentional disengagement from the visceral signal.
Which is basically weightlifting for the prefrontal cortex, while the insula is throwing a tantrum.
Here's the practical piece I want listeners to actually try. Track your bloating episodes alongside distraction severity on a simple 1 to 10 scale. Nothing complicated, just note the meal, the bloat level, and how much it derailed your cognition. The interoceptive training study from last year found a 40% reduction in distress after 8 weeks. But you won't know if these techniques are working for you unless you have a baseline.
The challenge is straightforward. Next time bloating hits and you feel your brain glitching, before you send that misspelled text, do the 2-minute vagal reset. 4 in, 6 out. Then see if your spelling improves.
That points to something bigger that I think is exciting. The interoceptive training study from last year was small, but it opened a door. What if we could do real-time fMRI neurofeedback? Someone watches their own insula activity on a screen and practices turning it down while they're actually bloated.
That sounds expensive and mildly science fiction, but the principle is sound. If you can see the dial, you can learn to adjust it.
Or wearable vagus nerve stimulators. Non-invasive ones already exist for migraine and cluster headaches. The question is whether targeted vagal stimulation during bloating episodes could short-circuit the cognitive loop before it spirals. Nobody's run that trial yet, but the pathway is there.
We're at the edge of something that doesn't quite have a name yet.
treating the brain side of gut disorders as aggressively as the gut side. The 40% distress reduction in that pilot study suggests it's not theoretical. The brain can learn to reinterpret the signal.
Which means Daniel's instinct was right. Tackling this at the mental level isn't plan B. For someone with an ADHD amplified interoceptive alarm, it might be the most direct intervention available.
Here's the challenge. Next time you're bloated and you feel your thoughts scrambling, before you send that text, do the 2-minute vagal reset, 4 seconds in, 6 seconds out. Then see if your spelling improves, and tell us what happens.
Your brain can learn to turn down the volume on bloating. It just needs practice.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1914, an Icelandic merchant named John Stephenson nearly introduced the Chinese swan pan abacus to Reykjavik's fishing trade as a replacement for paper ledgers. The shipment sank in Faxaflói Bay during a storm, and Iceland's bookkeepers never learned they almost became abacus users.
A shipwrecked abacus fleet. That's a very specific near miss for Icelandic accounting.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you try the vagal reset or any of the other techniques, we want to hear from you. Email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. Go breathe slowly at your insula.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.